Into hour number two. My name is Jim Rome. Great to be with you. This show is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage with you every step of the way to provide a seamless mortgage experience. A lot of action coming out of SoCal, right? We talked about the Lakers, and I told you it is now safe to break out those car flags. Do it. They look great. The Chargers are not going to London. Don't believe me? Check with their owner, Dean Spanos.
Total. Okay. We're not going to London. We're not going anywhere. We're playing in Los Angeles. This is our home, and this is where we're planning to be for a long time. Period.
We need more of that.
Okay. And if you want me to say
F-bombing owners insisting that their team is not going, quote, anywheres. 1-800-636-8686.
Anywhere.
I love it. As promised, we're joined right now by a former NFL player. He played 14 years in the NFL. He was a two-time Pro Bowler. He was undrafted out of UTEP. He's an unbelievable magician. He is also now an author. He's got a brand new book out. It's called Life is Magic. John Dornbos is my guest. John, good to have you back on. How are you?
Hey, rock star. Thank you for having me.
Oh, man. So, John, you and I spoke back in 2016 about your incredible story, but there's a lot to catch up on. First off, I got to ask you, how does it feel to add published author and Amazon bestseller to your list of accomplishments?
Ridiculous, because let's be honest, I had not one English teacher my entire life that thought, A, I would be published, and B, it would be a bestseller. So just breaking odds, baby. Just breaking odds.
All right, so you're breaking odds. And anybody listening right now, John, I think knows your story, and they heard it back in 2016. But for those who do not know this, it's important to reset it, and it's something you talk about and something you write about, but I still want to be really sensitive in how we deal with this. But when you were 12 years old, your father killed your mother. I cannot begin to imagine what that must have been like. When you share that story now and you write about this in the book, what types of things do you talk about?
Well, so for me, life came full circle, and I had years of therapy. And during that time, I was learning what forgiveness was and what it meant to me. And so my wife and I, we had our first daughter 5 months ago. And right before my daughter was born, I realized it was time for my life to come full circle and sit down with my dad for the first time in 26 years and tell him that I forgive you. And what I was trying to do is find motivation that would make me a better father, a better husband. And I truly believe that if we can take motivation from defeat, failure, and from the worst things that happen to us, then I think we're going to make this world a better place. So when people read my book, I hope that they take away a few things that maybe help them find clarity, help them find forgiveness, get rid of bitterness, and just live happy.
John Dornbos joining us. You know, there's a lot to unpack in that, and I want to get into it. The book is called Life is Magic. It's out right now, and I do want to talk about that meeting you had with your father. But as you go back at that time, magic, of course, played a role in helping you cope back at that time. How so? Why was that so important?
So I got into magic when I lost my parents. And what it was is, and I didn't realize it till later in life, but when I would sit down and shuffle cards, I would get lost, and the chatter of the world would disappear. And I was just a kid. And so for me, it was my time to just be a kid, and my brain would process things, right? So I found 52 buddies in a deck of cards that they never lie to me, and they always tell me what I'm wrong. And to this day, when I'm looking for that peace in the world, I sit down at a table, and I just listen to the cards riffle and shuffle, and it just takes me away.
John Dornbos joining us. Also, John, there is a spot in Huntington Beach that also plays a role in all of this because it's a place where you would go to think about and talk to your mom. What were those moments like?
So when my mom passed, we opened her jewelry box, and she had three necklaces that she was going to give us kids when we turned 18. But obviously, she passed before I turned 18, so they gave me that necklace. Lo and behold, I went to Huntington Beach, California. It fell off in the ocean. I was devastated. And that was probably the first time that I realized I can change the story and find some positivity in that. And I told myself that my mom wanted to go around the world, and that necklace was never meant for me to wear. And instead, a whale took it over to Hawaii, and then a turtle took it to Australia, and then she went to Thailand and the Philippines. So for me, anytime I would sit at the ocean and anytime I see the ocean, now I know that my mom's been there and done that, and I can talk to her.
John Dornbos joining us. He's got a brand new book. It's called Life is Magic. It's out right now. At one point when you were in that spot, you said, John, quote, I want more in this life. I don't want to be somebody who lives in circumstance. I want to be a person of vision, end quote. I mean, that's pretty profound. What do you remember about that time, and what were you feeling then?
So I went back to the beach in my 20s. I felt like it was time for me to move on, and it was time for me to get rid of this bitterness and hate and anger of my dad murdering my mom. And so I looked up in the sky, and I said, hey, Mom, it's time that I forgive Dad within myself. and find clarity. But I didn't, for you know, and there was a part of me that felt like my mom was going to be upset and that it was about picking sides. And I think that was the moment that I started to learn that forgiveness isn't about picking sides. It's not about winning, losing. It's not about I'm okay with what you did, I agree with what you did, or evening the score. I learned that forgiveness for me is just coming to terms with my reality, being okay with my past, being okay with where I am in this world, and just letting go of bitterness. And so I looked up in the sky, and that was kind of the first time that I felt like I wanted to forgive my dad in order to be the man that my mom always wanted me to be and do good things in this world.
John Dornbos joining us. He played 14 years in the NFL. And then, John, speaking of football, we talked about your football career back in 2016 and the incredible circumstances surrounding that. But then in 2017, you were traded to New Orleans. During a physical, the doctors discovered something. What was it, and what was that moment like when you were told that news?
Yeah, so at the time, I'm 37 years old. I just signed a three-year extension for more money than I'd ever made. I played a game with the New Orleans Saints, and sure enough, I went and took my physical, and they discovered I had a severely leaky valve, so I had blood leaking back into my heart, as well as an aneurysm in the aorta that leaves the heart. So there's basically a vein that leaves your heart. It should be about the size of a dime or a nickel, and mine was the size of a Coke can. If that thing pops like a water balloon, you die instantly. And so my aneurysm got way too big. My heart got too big. Blood was leaking everywhere. And they basically said, you're never playing football ever again, and you're going to be in emergency open heart surgery probably in the next 48 hours. And had you played this Monday night and got hit in the chest, you had a far greater chance of dying than living.
So when you hear news like that, I mean, you're a professional athlete. You play a very violent game. You're used to getting hurt. You understand that. You take care of it. You get surgery. You get back to work. This is not that in any way. When you were told that news, what was that like? How did you process that?
Well, all of a sudden, my career was over. My life had been turned upside down. I was out over $3 million. And you're just trying to process. And then you become a victim, right? You start getting bitter. You start getting angry. You're like, wait, this is not how my career is going to end. I had worked so hard, made a couple Pro Bowls. This isn't, right? I've worked too hard for this. And then sure enough, you got to snap out of it. And you got to tell yourself a story, just like I did when I lost my necklace, in order to find peace in this situation and realize that life happens. And it happened to me, and it doesn't matter whether I agree or not. And so I basically was like, man, you know, my mom's best friend sang Wind Beneath My Wings at her funeral. And I remember I had the wind beneath my wings when I was an Eagle for so long. And when I found out the news, a guy named Drew Brees walked by, and I saw his last name Breeze. So the story I told myself is I had to step out of the wind and catch a breeze. And for whatever reason, I was traded to New Orleans to have my life saved by a saint. And so now it was about reevaluating my life and being happy that I was alive and being okay with whatever life was going to have in store for me. But me going to New Orleans wasn't about me playing football. It was about saving my life.
John Dornbos joining us. So it's about having your life saved by a saint. But then at the same time, pragmatically, I guess, you're doing your homework on the right doctor, and this one name keeps coming up. You call this guy, and you find out, not only is he an Eagles fan, but the doctor says to you, and I want to read the quote, "I can't tell you how excited I am that you called me. I'm just going to lay it out there for you. There's nobody better than me at this. I'm going to tell you right now, if you were just having a valve replacement, yeah, there are a handful of surgeons in America that you could go to and you'd be fine, but if you want a valve replacement and an aneurysm fix, get your ass on a plane, come to Philly, let me save your life," end quote. First of all, John, who was the doctor, and what do you remember about that call?
So we had called all these surgeons around the world, and every one of them had been taught by this guy named Joseph Bavaria at University of Penn. And so sure enough, back in Philadelphia, we call him, we get him on the phone, and that literally was like verbatim exactly what he said. And, you know, my wife and I just looked at each other, and we just remember the swag, right? Get your ass on a plane and let me save your life. And he said, I'm an artist, I'm eloquent. The reality is we're going to have a lot of information, but until we go in there, you never know what's going to happen. So if anybody's in there that you want it to be me. So my wife and I got on the plane. We headed to Philly. And fortunately for me, I was able to get in with the number one surgeon in the world for the exact surgery that I needed. And it was just amazing.
John Dornbos joining us. He's got a new book. It's called Life is Magic. The book is out right now. The thing is, John, as much confidence, as much swag as that surgeon had, open heart surgery is still one of the scariest things ever. What was the night before the surgery like? And then what do you remember about the morning of the surgery and the moment when you were wheeled away from your wife?
Oh, my God. You're going to get me choked up. So you're kind of in this stage of denial, and you become like an athlete, and there's a process, and you're preparing for the moment, right? But the magnitude and the emotion of it doesn't set in until it happens. And so we prepared. We got ourselves in a position to be successful, just like you do as an athlete. And then the morning of, I'll never forget when I got wheeled out, and they told my wife, this is as far as you can come. and I turned the corner, and it was the moment that I didn't see my wife. And that's when it all hit me. And then the anesthesiologist came up to me, and she said, hey, I'm going to put a mask on you. You're going to go to sleep. So tell me what island you want to go to, and I'm going to send you there, and you're going to wake up and be good to go. And in that moment, I literally saw myself dipping my wife on the beach in Mexico when we got married. And I said, hey, take me back to my wedding day because it was the best day of my life. And I never tell my wife goodbye. I always tell her I'll kiss you soon. So sure enough, the surgery was supposed to be 4 or 5 hours. It ended up being close to 11. And the anesthesiologist came out about 8, 9, 10 hours into it, out there just wanting to know what's going on. And just like in a movie, she walked up and said, everything's good. It's going to take us about an hour and a half to sew him back up. And by the way, right before your husband went under, he wanted me to tell you that he'll kiss you soon. And my wife lost it. And just, that was an emotional time.
John, I think everybody listening right now is getting choked up on that. What do you remember? And again, just so they're clear on this, it was supposed to be 4 hours. It lasted more than 10. The doctor said that your sternum was the hardest he'd ever had to crack. He literally was standing on a stool to get leverage. What do you remember about waking up? Do you?
You know, I remember my wife saying, honey, you have to squeeze my hand. Honey, you have to squeeze my hand. And I barely squeezed it. And then I remember them putting ice chips on my lip, and ice chips have never tasted so good. And then I remember my wife saying, honey, you have to move your feet. You have to move your feet. And so sure enough, I would move my toes. And I was going in and out, in and out. But basically, the nurses were telling her, as you come out of the anesthesia and as you come out of the ICU, there's checklists that your husband has to do in order to wake up to make sure that everything's working. Have him squeeze your finger, have him move his toes, and just get any response you can. And so when those responses happen, I just remember hearing my wife sigh, and then I would just fall back asleep. And then I'd wake up, move your toes, move your toes. And I'd move my toes. And then I'd feel my wife's head just kind of hit my shoulder and just sigh. And then I'd fall back asleep.
John Dornbos joining us. He's got a book out, and the book is brand new. You want to get this. You know, John, something else. I have to skip ahead. There's so much. I wish I could cover this whole thing, but there's so much more. You mentioned your daughter. You have a five-month-old daughter. What is she like, and what's that experience been like?
It's the most amazing thing in the world. And I've never had such joy. And I've never had such accountability that now I realize that my daughter is looking up to me. And as a man in today's world who's been suffered and been a part of a house with domestic violence that changed our life forever, you know, I think as men, we need to take responsibility and treat people right and show our kids an example and learn how to get an outlet for our anger and our rage. And so my daughter's looking up to me. And she's seen how I treat her mom, and she's seen how I treat people. And I realize that that's what she's going to come to expect in any relationship she has. So it's a new sense of me dating my wife. It's a new sense of me dating my daughter. And I love everything about being a dad, and I can't wait to be the dad that I never had.
Late in the book, John, you write that recovery is a funny thing. There isn't any one moment when you realize when you're back to being you. Can you lay that out for me? What do you mean by that?
So open-heart surgery has a lot of side effects, and I was on 21 pills. And so you have different stages of depression, anger. You have different. You get really, really frustrated and annoyed, and you're trying to come back to you, and then you reach this time where all of a sudden it's 6 or 7 months later, you're starting to get off the meds, and you get really frustrated at things that normally you wouldn't, and you realize it, but you can't snap out of it. And so it's just this weird dynamic of kind of rediscovering who you are. And look, you got all these, you know, I had cadavers in me. I had foreign tissue in me. So your hormones are just going crazy. Your body's trying to figure out what's going on. So you have these emotional and mood swings. And, you know, I don't know if I'll ever be the same. But every day is a struggle to get back to who I was, to get back to that path of happiness. And, you know, that's why I'm proud of this book, is that if people are struggling with something, or they need closure, or they need forgiveness, or they're bitter at something, I really think that there's things in this book that they'll read that might help them find just that.
I'm going to ask you about closure in one moment. There is one point, though, where you went to see Mike Tyson's one-man show, of all
Amazing.
Things. Yeah, so what was that experience like? What kind of an impact did that have on you?
Well, so I'm a performer, and I love it. And you get, you know, whether it's Carrot Top or Garth Brooks or all these people influence your show. Well, for me, Mike Tyson, I saw him. He does a 90-minute one-man show that is absolutely phenomenal. And he's self-deprecating. He's funny. He's vulnerable. And literally, I mean, for the people that have seen his show, like, the guy's up there, and he's making himself out to be, like, the scumbag, like, beating up ladies, stealing things, just not caring. But at the same time, when somebody's vulnerable and honest, you start reflecting on yourself, and you start looking at yourself in the mirror, realizing that I'm not perfect either, and you relate to him. And now you got the most feared man in the world, and I'm like, wait a minute, he's got issues too. why can't I do this? I've been seeking out to try and accomplish this. Well, if Mike Tyson can do it, why can't I? And all of a sudden, you start finding inspiration and motivation within the vulnerability. That's a powerful thing. And when I saw Mike Tyson, I said, you know what? I need to be more vulnerable in my own show. And I need to start sharing things so that the audience connects with me just like I'm connecting to him right now.
John Dorenbos, my guest. So you mentioned closure. The book ends with a chapter titled Closure. I don't want to give too much of this away, but what is that chapter about? And how did the events of that chapter come to be?
So the last chapter is the moment that I decide that it's time for me to go and sit and have lunch with my dad. And I remember growing up, my friends would say, hey, you want to go meet my dad and I for lunch? And I would always say yes, and I would try and meet them there because I wanted to walk in and I wanted to watch and see them sitting together as a father and son. And I had father figures in my life, but my biological dad obviously wasn't around. He was in prison. And so the final chapter is me kind of facing myself in the mirror saying, it's time to forgive. And it's time to find motivation in this dysfunctional relationship that I had with my dad in this horrible tragedy of him killing my mom. It's time to take this and find motivation to make myself a better father and to make myself a better husband. And I got to do it. So I went and I sat and I had a 5.5-hour lunch. I had lunch with my dad for the very first time. And I felt every emotion. It was super intense. And I took the road less traveled, I think. And I'm really glad I did it.
So forgiveness is a really powerful, really heavy concept. What then does it mean to you?
You know, forgiveness isn't about winning and losing. It's not about, I agree with what you did. It's not about keeping score. I realized that for me, I didn't need my dad's validation. I didn't need answers or excuses. I didn't need anything from him. I needed to be there for me. And I forgave him for me so that this cloud that was in my head of bitterness and anger and defeat, I can just let that go and actually be okay with my life, be okay with my past and say to myself, not everybody's perfect. We all have our issues and problems. In fact, that's life. The one thing that we can all relate to in life, I feel, is that moment when life's not going our way. It doesn't matter how much money you have or race, religion, or titles. It doesn't matter. One thing that we will always all relate to is the moment where life's ganging up on us and it's tackling us. But that moment that we stand up, that's what separates us. And I decide I'm going to live in vision. I'm not going to live in circumstance. I'm not going to make an excuse. And I'm going to live every day to try and bring pride back to my last name. So when people hear the name Dorenbos, they think of something great. They think of something positive and not of my dad murdering my mom.
I love that, John. I'm going to live my life in vision and not in circumstance. Former NFL player, 14 years in the NFL, 2-time Pro Bowler, a magician, and now an author who has written an amazingly powerful book. This book is called Life is Magic. It is out right now. John, congrats. I know I can't even begin to fathom what it must have been like to write that book, but you did it. You got it out there. It's amazing, and it's really good to have you back on the show. John, thanks so much.
I love you, man. Thank you.
Thank you. John Dorenbos. Have not had very many conversations quite like that. All right, telephone number is toll free. You are more than welcome to respond or react to that. That was an amazing conversation. John Dorenbos, author, magician, former NFL player. Coming up at 40 past, Herman Moore, former NFL wide receiver, joins us. Episode 103 of the Jim Rohn podcast going out later on today. NHL Hall of Famer, Timo Solani. John Dorenbos forgave his father, who murdered his mother, and sat down and had a meal with him and was there for over 5 hours because he wants to be somebody who lives in vision and not circumstance. All right, we're coming right back. Stay tuned. Sunday, the NFL on CBS features the Chiefs taking on the Titans, or an NFC encounter between the Lions and the Bears, all beginning with JB and the fellas. On the NFL Today at noon Eastern, 9 Pacific on CBS. That interview with John Dorenbos, I'm blown away. Like, I've spoken to him. We've talked about these things, but still. And there was obviously a bunch of things that we had not spoken about, and it's all in his book. That was an amazing conversation, I thought. I've got Herman Moore coming up next segment. Third hour is wide open. Let's get a phone call or two in here quickly. We go to Texas. Johnny in Texas. Good to have you, Johnny. How are you?
Hey, Jimmy. Appreciate the Vine. Thanks for that interview. It's good to be back in the jungle. I am just absolutely blown away. You know, since 2006, I've been following you, and I have to say I've never caught that guy before, but but amazing. And so thank you for that story, because, you know, forgiveness is one of those things that we should all be able to offer, but it takes a hell of a lot of work to get there, doesn't it? Thanks for the research on him, too, bringing up his background, and I, that's what I've always appreciated about your show. Jim, you know, one of the things that I think you need to remind people, there's probably at least 1,000 people on the radio right now listening to you that have never come in contact. Remind them, like you reminded me back in 06, to pay attention to the show for a couple of weeks and give you a chance, because otherwise it's impossible to get the jungle. You got to know what the drops mean. You got to know who the clones are. You got to know the jokes and the inside stories. And I'm grateful that I spent that time when I had it back in 06, like I said. But listen, I got loose on Twitter a couple of months back, and it was regretful. I said something about someone that I want to apologize for publicly. She knows who she is. I didn't mean anything by it, and I'm sorry. Hey, Jim, the jungle has given me an opportunity to meet up with a couple of damn good clones. That's SA Sports Talk, and can you believe Dr. Dave in Chicago. Met those guys at the Riverwalk a couple weekends ago. Good people. There's a bunch of good clones in the jungle right now that I've got to know a little bit better. Mark in the 925, Clifford, Silly Blonde Girl, Bella B, more of those people. Hey, and Kirby, what's going on, brother? I'll catch up with you soon. Jim, thank you for the Vine. Like I said, war wrestling, war erections, war me. I'm out.
Johnny, my man, did you war yourself after that call? Covered a lot of ground, didn't he? What he was talking about was, Johnny said, you know, I bet there's like maybe 1,000 people listening right now that need to hear this. Let me, point of clarification, let me help you with that. There's like 8 million people listening right now, John. But what he was talking about was back in the day, I used to say, as a disclaimer, the show is a very different show. You've never heard a show like this before. You've never heard a host like this before. You're not going to like it. I know you won't, inevitably. Very rare was the listener who, when I started, I'm talking about back in the 90s, and especially like in the very beginning, there was like a kind of a sense of, damn, you know, what is this? And then people, after they heard it for a time, and I got in a few years, knew what it was, but didn't like it at all. And I understood this. I knew the reaction was always really visceral and really like, man, I hate this guy. I hate this guy. And my reaction to that would be, all right, that's fine. I accept that. No matter what, some of you are going to hate me. I get that. That's what I signed up for. In fact, if you didn't hate me, I wouldn't be doing my job. And then I got beyond that point because I realized that no matter who you were, if you got behind a mic, people are going to hate you no matter what you said or what you did, no matter how polarizing, no matter how emphatic. I mean, you could have been the most vanilla person ever and never said anything and never had a single take. People would hate your guts. X would always hate. But my point was, some of you who think you hate are going to love my ass. Give it 2 weeks. It's a different show. You need to see how I do it. You need to see where I'm coming from. You need to see how I conduct my interviews. You need to kind of know my point of view. And then you have to understand the jungle itself and the people who call the show and the people who interact with the show. And then inevitably, a number of you would say, hey, Rome, you're right, man. I hated your guts. I wanted to fight you the first time I heard you. But after a couple of weeks, I kind of figured out where you were coming from. And I'm like, this guy's funny. This guy's smart. This guy's talented. This show is really good. And then somebody would say, hey, radio man. I listened for 2 weeks, and you know what? I hate you even more than I did when I started listening. I'd say, fair enough. I accept that. Or I would, if you were a little brighter, give it 2 more weeks. You're a little slow on the uptake. And if after 1 month you can tell me you still hate my guts, then I will own that. So that's what Johnny's talking about. And here's John 13 years later. 1-800-636-8686. He made it in. Who's next? Herman Moore actually is next. And then we have open phones. Now we're number 3. Cam Newton is done for the year and probably done in Carolina, and I have thoughts on that. That's coming up. Evander Kane sued by the Cosmopolitan Hotel for 500 gur. Bro, don't take out the markers if you're not going to pay them back, allegedly. Here is your sports update.
Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jim Rome. If you're on hold, stay there. Third hour, we have open phones, but right now we are joined by somebody who played 12 years in the NFL, 11 of them with the Detroit Lions. He was a four-time Pro Bowler. He was a three-time All-Pro. He retired as the Lions team leader in career receptions, receiving yards, and TD catches. He was an All-American indoor and outdoor ACC high jump champion and a Heisman Trophy finalist. He was the 10th pick overall in 1991 out of Virginia. He is working with Quick Lane Tire and Auto Center. And we'll talk about that too. Herman Moore is my guest. Herman, great to have you on. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me.
It is great to have you and lots to talk about. Your former team, the Lions, are coming off a tough loss to Oakland. Let me start right there because they did start the year 2-0-1, but they've dropped three of their last four. So, Herman, eight games in, what kind of thoughts do you have about the team?
Well, right now the thoughts are really this is a team that's having some struggles. Offensively, they're trying to outscore their opponents, and I don't know if this team is good enough to do that on a consistent basis, definitely not week in and week out. They're going to need some help from the struggling defense that right now are not committing enough people to the pass rush because they're trying to protect the secondary. So there are some problems going into a critical part of the season. And right now we know that the month of November is where teams are deciding on their postseason opportunities and also whether or not they're going to have division titles.
Herman Moore joining us. You know, you also made the point on Twitter that the running game is going to be vital for the success of this team. You know the way the game is played right now. It's pass first, pass, pass, pass. Lay it out for me. What do you mean by that? Why is the running game so critical to this crew?
Well, this is a team that has players that, especially when you look at the tight ends and then you look at the big play capability by the wide receivers, play action is big for them. They're able to, you know, draw up those secondary guys or be able to get them to have to commit out of the zone coverage or combo coverages into single coverage. Well, that's a tough task for a lot of these defensive backs against the likes of a Marvin Jones, or you start looking at a Kenny Galladay and even T.J. Hockenson. I mean, they're tough to manage that way. But if they can let guys play back and only have to rush a couple guys, then that becomes problematic because they have no fear of the run. And the only thing I would say is this, Jim, is that if you can't get the running game going, then perhaps you need to start implementing another receiver into the progression to where now they're looking to get that 3 to 5 yards and it becomes more of a read pattern.
Herman Moore is sounding like the four-time Pro Bowler he is, three-time All-Pro. He's working with Quick Lane Tire and Auto Center, and I'll pick that up a little bit later on. So, Herman, earlier this season, Matthew Stafford became the fastest player in league history to get to 40,000 passing yards. What do you make of that accomplishment and him as a quarterback? In other words, does he get the respect that he deserves?
I don't think necessarily he gets the respect he deserves nationally and league-wide. I think there's an appreciation, kind of bittersweet, even in the Michigan markets, because he's kind of grandfathered into some of the failures from the past. And that with that means that they're not as up on him and high on him as they really should be. He's a guy, they look at his win-loss record versus 500 or better teams. They look at the lack of the playoffs, performances and things of that nature, but he's been very durable, he's been very consistent, and he's been kind of the Iron Man of this position. And for Matthew Stafford, you look for that in a quarterback. Anytime you have a franchise that you can go with one guy for so long, there's something to be said about that. And I think there's many teams around the NFL who would love to have a player of his caliber that thinks that that's the missing piece. So, you know, does he get the recognition and the accolades that he deserves? Probably not. But does he need to also have some of those things like championships and division titles and also competing on the conference championship games? Absolutely. And I think short of that, he will never really hit that level other than being a guy that has a lot of stats.
We're talking to Herman Moore. Now, Herman, everybody knows how the game has changed in terms of what a defensive back and a linebacker can do. But for perspective, as a receiver, take everybody back to when you played. What was it like to try to get off the line of scrimmage, and what could DBs do to you back then?
That was a challenge in itself. You would always be worried or concerned a little bit about how would a team play you once you defeated that first defensive back. I knew that they would either walk up a safety and let the defensive back get really aggressive and then stack another guy behind them. Sometimes they bring up a linebacker, especially if you were a point in the slot position and we used to run a trip set out of the slot. That guy, you had no room. You can't really take a release inside. You really couldn't release outside because the linebackers were so strong and they were big and they would crowd the line. And within 5 yards back then, Jim, you know, it was everything goes. I mean, they could grab, they could hit. And if you ran that drag route and you weren't 5 yards deep and you had your head looking back at the quarterback, you could get wiped out on the other side and it wouldn't be illegal. The middle was open for your safeties. So it's changed quite a bit. And it was a challenge getting off the line, to say the least.
So if you get off the line, Herman, what was it like to run across the middle of the field in the NFC back in the day?
It was brutal because not only did you have to contend with safeties that were very aggressive, but you also had to deal with the implementation of Tony Dungy's Tampa 2. And you didn't know what linebacker was going to be running down and scouting you in the middle for one of those in routes. So you really had a couple layers there that you had to navigate that ultimately meant that if you did catch a pass, 9 times out of 10, you were going to get what we call blown up. You weren't necessarily just going to go through there and escape.
You had Tony Dungy's linebackers. Then you had John Lynch back there in the secondary, too.
A linebacker playing safety, absolutely. Number 47. And when you start remembering guys' numbers so easily, then you know.
That's such a great point. Like, Herman, what's another number? If I were to say to you, give me another number that comes to mind of a guy, like what other number or other numbers do you remember?
Steve Atwater.
Yep.
Carnell Lake. Even Ronnie Lott, near the end of his career, he was still moved over to safety. And Ronnie's one of those guys that sold out. You know, when he would just come after you, he would come in Lord of the Boom. So there were guys all across. Chuck Cecil, I ended up playing against him when he was out with the Houston Oilers near the end of his career, when he was all about how many people could he knock out and knock himself out in the path of that.
So. Do you remember that, Herman? Like, well, I don't remember the exact caption, but Chuck Cecil was on the cover of SI that one year, right? Like the most dangerous man in the NFL. Atwater, too, especially. But then the amazing thing, Herman, you had 123 receptions in 1995. Given the way the game was officiated back then and the way we're talking about it, if you were allowed, or if you could play right now when defenses can no longer do these things, what kind of numbers would you put up when you consider the way the game is officiated now?
If I was still playing and then playing with a coordinator like Tom Moore, who you've seen what he's done everywhere he's gone, whether it's Arizona or Indianapolis, that was one that was geared towards guys that could get open, catch the ball, and make things happen. I think 150 for people in that system, your top guy should average between 140 and 150 a year in this climate, in this day and age.
Herman, you're my guest. No, no doubt. So Saturday, let me ask you this. You, Lomas Brown, and a number of former Lions players accompanied a group of 79 veterans from World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, and you went to D.C. What was your reaction when that first came up, and then what was that trip like?
You know, words really can't do it any justice, and I didn't know what to expect when I was asked to be one of the guardians that would go out with these military veterans and to tour D.C. and to see just these monuments and the memorials and all these things that would bring back so many memories. It was fun the first night because these guys got a chance to meet one another. They were from all different places around the country and different branches of the military. And then the next day when we got out to D.C., it was just quiet on the bus. And you look at them looking around. And then when we got to go to the different sites, whether it was, you know, for Vietnam or Korea or World War II, It was surreal because you realize the sacrifices and the unselfishness that these guys have made to protect people they don't even know and they may never even meet. That's an ultimate sacrifice. So it was an honor for me to be there with them and to support them and take them around. And I hope I get invited to do it again.
What an amazing experience. NFL great Herman Moore, my guest. You're working with Quick Lane Tire and Auto Center. Herman, what are you doing with them?
Well, with Quick Lane Tire and Auto Center, I have a trading one uniform for another program, which awards $10,000 scholarships to military veterans. But also they've opened it up so that you can also include our first responders. Nominations have started for that scholarship. And we know Veterans Day is coming up on Monday, so we tell you to keep them in mind, not just then, but going through, if you know of someone, to nominate them. You have until December 6th to do so. And then we're going to announce the winners on December 26th at the Quick Lane Bowl. And for those who don't know about Quick Lane has been a title sponsor for the past 6 years and also over 800 locations across the country. So this is a wonderful, wonderful company and organization that's made a commitment back to those that are so deserving.
Very, very good cause. Glad to talk about it. Herman, one last thought. You had a tweet and you had this picture of you in the weight room and a great caption, quote, "Getting it in. I take my mental and physical health seriously. 30 pounds kicking my butt doing high reps. Plus, I don't want to look like I never played the game." Man, I love that attitude. When you work as hard as you did during your career, it would be easy and tempting to kind of let yourself go in retirement like you earned it, but you haven't done that. How come?
Because one thing, my wife, she does a lot of personal training, but she's also in the mental and physical health space. So going out and making sure that I take care of myself and set the example for my two sons, they're 26 and 27. If you want longevity in life, you got to take care of yourself. This is the only vehicle we got that's going to carry us the rest of the way. So we got to take care of it, not just on the physical, but the mental side as well.
He retired as the Lions team leader in career receptions, receiving yardage and TD catches, 12 years in the NFL, four-time Pro Bowler, and today appearing compliments of Quick Lane Tire and Auto Center. Herman, great to get caught up. I appreciate it so much. Great to have you back.
Hey, Jim, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Herman. Well done. What a class act. 1-800-636-8686. Man, I can't stress that enough. I love the way he laid out what it was like to play the game back then, before the rule changes. And the guys that he mentioned, Atwater, Steve Atwater was fierce. Ronnie Lott was fierce. Chuck Cecil was one of the scariest dudes ever. Carnell Lake. Carnell Lake actually lives in our area. Jake and his son were friends. Chuck Cecil, man, I was so fascinated by Cecil because he was just the scariest dude. I remember, you probably don't have any sound out, but I remember we had him on. I'm like, that's one of those things. We used to talk about it quite a bit. Kyle Brandt and I would talk about it. You know, like stakes, high stakes, stakes for an interview. Cecil was one of those guys because he just, you have to understand, back in the day when there was no social, a lot of these guys were really mysterious. I'll give you an example. Like, remember Tom Brady? Remember how you thought Brady was like the coolest dude ever? Until he showed up on Facebook and social, and you found out he's not anything like you thought, i.e. not that cool. Before there was social, and especially these DBs who were like so intimidating and so fierce, like you didn't know what they were about. Cecil was one of those guys. He just was so mysterious and so dangerous and so scary. So for Herman Moore to put up the numbers that he put up, I love the way he explained it too. When I said, what about John Lynch? He goes, yeah, 47. When I know guys' as numbers, that's the ultimate sign of respect. They're just a number, 47. All right, we'll come back. Third hour, straight up, wide open, 1-800-636-8686. Do not go anywhere.